This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people. Hello, welcome to this episode of the MDT podcast. I'm Dr. Joe Preston, and I am a consultant geriatrician down in South London.
And I'm Dr. Ian Wilkinson. I'm a consultant geriatrician in Surrey. And today we're going to be talking about hypertension.
And faculty that helped us make this episode are Pam Trangmar.
And Pam is a physician associate over in Medway. During this episode, we have also had a chat with Mike Corey, who's a consultant in hypertension down in Brighton. And you'll hear Mike at various different points with his thoughts on some of the things we're talking about. So this episode coming up this week, we are going to have a think about the importance of managing hypertension in older people. We're going to hopefully give you a bit of a greater insight into a little bit of the research basis behind hypertension and why hypertension happens. We're going to hopefully furnish you with some skills to talk to a patient about the non-pharmacological interventions to help blood pressure control, and also how to take a blood pressure properly. And then hopefully get you to understand that the prescription of antihypertensive is very much an individualised process, and one patient is very different to another.
What we're not going to really talk about today is the ins and outs of the different medical treatment options. There's quite good guidance on that, and quite often in older adults you need to individualise that anyway. So we're going to talk about the principles behind that decision.
And a couple of things to tell you about. Don't forget we have the MDT Club.
Yes.
Using the hashtag MDT Club on Twitter.
Run by Dan Thomas, who's a geriatrics registrar up north.
In Liverpool.
Liverpool.
Yeah, that'd be up north.
From here it is anyway.
Yeah, Dan runs this excellently. So pop along to Twitter, have a look, see what people are talking about. He runs, he kind of collates all the stuff people are talking about over the week and then puts it together in a nice sort of infographic style thing at the end of the week. It's excellent.
And don't forget that you can do a self-reflection on our CPD log on our website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk. And we will send you a summary of that for you to log for your revalidation.
Or your stick in your portfolio or whatever you're going to be doing. Yeah. Cool. So before we kick off on hypertension, Joe, we're going to talk about social media this week. What have you seen? What do you want to talk about?
So
what's the thing?
I have seen something from an American emergency physician website, which is a mnemonic for managing delirium. So it's not like new knowledge particularly, but I quite like it as a tool. Each one has only got sort of two or three things underneath it, but it's got all the references for and the evidence base behind each of these things. So the mnemonic is ADEPT, and it is assess, diagnose, evaluate, prevent and treat. And I quite like the references being there as well, because it kind of really shows that this isn't just things that we're saying, that there's an evidence base behind what we're saying when we're suggesting that you can treat this and prevent it. So I thought that was really quite nice.
Mine this week is a Twitter conversation between a whole load of people, actually, so I'm not going to name them all, but a Twitter conversation about, is a good bedside manner a good predictor of a good doctor?
Interesting.
And I think for good doctor, you could actually read good nurse, physiotherapist, allied health professional, whichever. I think that the principles are the same. So it was a really nice just conversation between three or four people talking through stuff. I'll put the link to it in the show notes so you can click on it and just have a skim through. But it was nice.
So what did you like particularly about it?
It was a bit about, is a good bedside manner just normal manners?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I thought was quite nice. And then it's kind of led on to a discussion about, well, and some stuff I thought about before, actually, that being a nice person and a nice doctor is good, but you also have to draw out what the patient wants from each consultation, and you can be perfectly nice but quite ineffectual.
Yes.
And actually there's that balance there.
Yeah.
Not being too focused on the outcome, you know, just doing stuff, but also not doing anything.
Yeah.
And that's all balance.
It's really difficult because you could be an excellent doctor, but if you can't communicate that well or get someone to trust you, then there's almost no point.
Yeah.
Because that shared decision making is not going to be there. But I can see that actually
you go too much the other way as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to it.
So we're going to talk, about hypertension.
Yes.
So it's kind of like high blood pressure, isn't it?
Kind of like it, yeah. So starting with the definition, we're going to talk through the NICE guidelines, which has a definition of stages. So stage one hypertension is blood pressure in clinic of 140 over 90 or higher, and subsequent ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, which is where you wear a blood pressure monitor and walk around with it for 24 hours, with a daytime average or home blood pressure monitoring average blood pressure of 135 over 85 or higher.
So 140 odd in clinic, mm-hmm. 135 over 85 at home. So a bit lower at home.
Yes.
Yep.
Stage two hypertension is obviously a little bit higher. So a clinic blood pressure of 160 over 100 or 150 over 95 on an ambulatory monitor or at home.
Okay, so again, a bit higher in the clinic, a bit lower at home.
Yes. And then severe hypertension is defined as a systolic blood pressure in clinic of 180 or higher, or a diastolic blood pressure of 110 or higher.
Okay, so it kind of splits it up into three sections.
Yes.
Stage one, stage two, and severe. Okay. I quite like the European Society of Cardiology one. And they talk about a systolic blood pressure of being the more than 140 millimetres of mercury and a diastolic of more than 90. And they have a cut-off value for home blood pressure or an ambulatory blood pressure of 135 over 85.
Which is the same as the stage one hypertension.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
But what also they do is they raise a couple of questions. And I think it's worth just thinking about now and then thinking about these as we go through the episode. So the first question is, and these are kind of like known unknowns. We know that we don't know the answer to this. So should elderly patients with a blood pressure between 140 and 160 systolic, so a bit up, be given antihypertensive treatment? And then the second is, are the lifestyle measures known to reduce blood pressure also capable of reducing morbidity and mortality in people with high blood pressure?
Which is a really important point, isn't it? You can treat the numbers, but if it's not going to make them feel any better or prevent disease or death, then is there a need to do it?
Exactly.
That's great.
Yeah. So I think the first thing what we should talk about is why hypertension happens. Then I think we should go into how to do a blood pressure. Then I think we should talk about the lifestyle stuff. And then I think we should talk about some studies.
I completely disagree.
Do you? Okay. What order do you want to go in?
No, I'm joking. Let's do it. So let's start with why hypertension happens.
Okay. I think we're going to nerd alert all of this for the next couple of minutes, because we're going to go into the mechanisms behind why hypertension happens in a little bit of detail.
A bit of physiology.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid.
So hypertension is quite a common condition. It's common because it's common across the board. We're talking about one in four adults in the UK having hypertension, and actually as you grow older it becomes an even more common disease. We're talking about people who are over 75, one in two, so that's every other, you know, older person. So it's a common disease, which is why I run a clinic in hypertension. It's important because it's strongly linked to cardiovascular risk. And as a lot of people know, cardiovascular disease is still the biggest cause of mortality in the UK and in many other parts of the world.
There's a really good article published in Age and Ageing earlier this year. The lead author is Simon Conroy from Leicester. And I'm just going to read you a little bit from that, and then we'll go into it in a bit more detail. So the structure and function of the vasculature changes with advancing age. Arteries narrow as a result of atherosclerosis, but also stiffen, leading to differences in how the systolic blood pressure wave is propagated through the arterial tree.
So how it moves along.
The loss of diastolic augmentation caused by stiff major arteries leads to a fall in perfusion pressure in the coronary arteries, and changes in cerebrovascular circulation lead to reductions in the cerebral perfusion reserve. So that's kind of the big picture.
And we talked about a reduction in cerebral reserve a little bit in the last episode on postural hypotension.
Yes, we'll come back to that in a second as well.
Yep. Some of the major effects of normal ageing on the cardiovascular system involve things like alterations in the aorta and in the blood vessels around the body. So the aorta and the large arteries, the wall thickness increases and the elasticity in the blood vessels decreases with age. So they get thicker and stiffer. And these changes cause a decline in the compliance of those arteries, which means their ability to change size, and an increase in your systolic blood pressure. The reduction in vessel elasticity, so its stretchability, results in an increase in the peripheral vascular resistance.
So that's the amount of, essentially, the size of the small vessels at the edge. So the smaller the vessels, the more resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know from the last episode, the blood pressure formula involves cardiac output and peripheral resistance.
It does.
So if your peripheral resistance goes up, your blood pressure goes up. And then that is sensed by baroreceptors. And the sensitivity of these is modified with your age. So you get alterations in the baroreceptor reflex mechanisms, and that can explain the variability in blood pressure that you get with continuous monitoring. So as the baroreceptor sensitivity decreases, that results in an impairment of your postural reflexes, making older people more sensitive to orthostatic hypertension. And we've done a whole episode on that 2 weeks ago.
Yes, indeed.
So if you've not listened to it, stop now, turn this off, go back to the previous episode, listen to that, and then come back. Yeah.
There's also changes in the balance of the sympathetic nervous system controlling whether the vessels dilate through beta adrenergic stimulation or vasoconstrict through alpha adrenergic vasoconstriction. And the balance tips towards vasoconstriction, which increases your peripheral vascular resistance and therefore increases your blood pressure.
Yeah. And then at the same time, you may have a degree of sodium retention, perhaps due to an increased intake or a decreased excretion of salt.
Which happens in the kidneys.
Yeah. And that can lead to hypertension. And as we get older, they've also demonstrated that you get a reduction in plasma renin levels. And the renin response to salt is more reduced as we get older in hypertensive patients versus normotensive patients.
Mm.
However, you may or may not know, the renin angiotensin system is not regarded as playing a particularly important role in hypertension in older people. And that is reflected in the medications and the guidelines. But we ain't going to talk about that.
So the renin-angiotensin system is part of what controls blood pressure, and that is kind of around the kidneys.
Yeah. So as you have a high blood pressure, if it goes on for a long time, then it's bad for you. And what happens is you get reduced cardiac output, you drop your heart rate a little bit, you get reduced cardiac contractility, the size of the left ventricle increases, and the diastolic dysfunction, so the relaxation of the heart, gets worse. And also, you can then get an impairment of kidney function and reduce renal perfusion and reduce glomerular filtration rate.
Which is kind of like the rate of the blood going through the kidneys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we talked about the problems of a low blood pressure in the last episode. And there's a U-shaped curve for mortality, so we need to think about balance. So do you want to explain what that means a bit more?
Yeah, so if you have a low blood pressure, mm-hmm. your mortality is higher than someone with a normal blood pressure. And then if you have a high blood pressure, your mortality is higher than someone with a normal blood pressure as well. So you kind of want it in the middle. Not too hot, not too cold, just right.
The porridge of blood pressures.
The porridge of blood pressures. The Goldilocks principles. Do you know about the Goldilocks principle of geriatric medicine?
Oh, you have told me this before, but I can't remember it.
So Goldilocks, what does she do? She goes into the house and the first thing she tries is the food. And it's got to be not too hot, not too cold, just right. So you've got to get the food right. She then tries a chair, and it's got to be not too big, not too small, just right. And she then gets the bed, so not too big, not too small, just right. So you've got to get the food, the daytime activity, and the sitting in the chair amount right, and the not too much time in bed right. Those three things right, you're on the way forward.
We've got a wooden carving of Goldilocks in seminar room.
That's why.
St. George's.
Yes, it was coined, I think, by Prof Millard.
Yeah.
Who your teaching room is named after.
It is. For ages, I was like, I don't know what that is. And then one of the older consultants in the department was like, explained it. I was like, okay. Yeah. Now I see why we have that here.
So this U-shaped curve.
Mm-hmm.
We know that from long-term studies, such as the Framingham Cardiovascular Study.
Which is one of the biggest studies that have been done.
That hypertension is not good for you. and it's associated with negative health outcomes. Did you know that the Framingham study is the origin of the term risk factor?
No.
It's the first time it was coined. And it showed that there are risk factors for poor health.
Those cardiologists always coin everything, don't they?
And, well, I think it's public health people, probably.
They are the unsung clever people, aren't
yes.
they?
Yes. So the risk factors for poor health were a poor diet, being overweight, and not taking good exercise.
Mm.
And Framingham was a large population-based study in the States, and it developed a 10-year cardiovascular risk calculator that we use at the moment. And that is based on what your blood pressure is, what your weight is, and various different bits. So in order to know that, we need to know how to measure a blood pressure.
Yeah, because you can only act on a proper reading, really.
Yeah. This sounds a bit pedantic, but it's important.
Heaven forbid. Okay, so when we're thinking about diagnosing someone with a high blood pressure or hypertension, you want to measure blood pressure in both arms because you might have differences. If there is a difference in the readings between the arms and it's more than 20 millimetres of mercury, then repeat the measurements. If the difference in the readings in the arms remains more than 20, then you use the readings from the higher arm.
Yeah.
So if your right arm has a higher level, you use that going forwards to measure.
And if you measure the blood pressure in clinic, if it's more than 140 over 90, do it again during the consultation. And if the second one is substantially different from the first, do it a third time.
And the reason for that is that there might be other things that have pushed their blood pressure up, like they've just rushed in, they're a bit stressed or nervous about coming in, so repeating the blood pressure can be quite helpful. Similarly though, if you've had quite an intense interaction with that person for whatever reason, repeating their blood pressure at that point may not be helpful because there's all sorts of things that can push your blood pressure up, including stress and anxiety.
And if it is up, then offer an ambulatory blood pressure to confirm the diagnosis.
So the first thing to do is hypertension is around sustained elevation in blood pressure. Now, to be confident that a blood pressure is sustained, your initial assessment needs to be robust. Now, there are certain confounders that may well affect the blood pressure measurement in clinic, so it's important to try and eliminate these as much as possible. Things as simple as a patient being cross-legged when the blood pressure has been taken, patients in pain, doing the blood pressure over thickened clothing, patient leaning forward. You know, sometimes I go to take blood pressure and the patient offers you their arm in order to be helpful. You know, that can elevate blood pressure. Patients who are talking, some clinicians feel that by talking to the patient whilst the blood pressure is being taken, it relaxes them, but actually this elevates blood pressure. And an accumulation of these confounders may well give you a spuriously high or elevated blood pressure. So it's important to eliminate those factors as much as possible.
And we talked in the last episode a little bit about how, like, physically how to take a blood pressure, what you're listening for when you're doing it yourself if you're not using an electronic system. So again, if you're not sure how to do that, go back an episode.
So if when you've done your blood pressure readings, a person has severe hypertension, then you might want to think about starting antihypertensive drug therapy straight away without waiting for any results of any ambulatory blood pressure monitoring or doing their blood pressure at home. There are certain circumstances where you might want to refer somebody that same day into specialist care. So those are things like something called accelerated hypertension, which is where the blood pressure is higher than 180 over 110, so severe, but with signs of swelling in the back of the eyes or any bleeding in the back of the eyes or any vision changes. So it's a particular skill at looking at the back of the eyes that probably only doctors would have, I would think, maybe some nurse practitioners who have learned the skill, or opticians, so anyone that is able to look at the back of the eye, so you need a piece of equipment to do that.
So if you measure someone's blood pressure and it's more than 180 over 110, you need to get someone to look in their eyes, if that's a new thing. So you need to find a way of doing that.
You also refer them in if you think that they might have something called a pheochromocytoma, which is a fancy word, and it's a particular type of tumour. Around the adrenal glands. And you might suspect that if someone has very labile blood pressures, it's up and down, headache, palpitations, pallor or sweating. So it's a kind of combination of symptoms, and that tends to not come on quickly. It tends to be something that you see or they will report having had for a short period of time, yeah, or a longer period of time.
And then when you've made a diagnosis of hypertension, so that's either with your in-clinic blood pressure or your ambulatory blood pressure at home that's raised above the various levels we've talked about, then whilst you're waiting for that sort of to be confirmed and check on it and start treatment, you should look for evidence of end organ damage. So the end organs we're thinking about really are the heart, we're thinking about the kidneys, and we're thinking about the eyes. Mm. So you're going to look for signs of left ventricular hypertrophy. So you can do that by examining someone with an ECG or an echocardiogram.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to look for signs of chronic kidney disease.
So you can do some blood tests. You can also do a urine dip looking for protein and blood.
Yep. And we might do an episode on kidneys at some point. and then you're going to look for evidence of hypertensive change in the back of the eye.
Yes.
Things like AV nipping, silver wiring and various bits that you can go and read about. Joe's shaking ahead of me. and also, you should do a formal assessment of cardiovascular risk using a cardiovascular risk assessment tool such as the Framingham one. And all of that comes pretty much verbatim from the NICE guidelines, and you're after clinical guideline 127 if you want to go and check that out.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
So next we're going to talk about lifestyle interventions, which is something that people quite often ask about, and I think sometimes we forget about a little bit, and I think we need to give it as much importance as the medications.
And here again, we've taken NICE guidelines, but we've sandwiched it in with the European Society of Cardiology Hypertension guidelines, which are brilliant. I'd never read them before.
They are, they're really
and
good.
And I've read them. They're fairly lengthy, but they
Long.
Are good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Find the section you want to read and just read that bit.
Yeah. Actually, sorry, they've got some really good summary cards.
They do,
you can read out, they're like, you know, a couple of sides of just key points. It's just good,
So lifestyle change is the cornerstone for preventing high blood pressure and also really important in its treatment. So lifestyle advice should be offered to people when they're diagnosed with high blood pressure, and then again periodically as you go along, while people are having treatment and assessment for hypertension to help with uptake. Relaxation therapies can help with blood pressure, and people may wish to pursue that as part of their treatment, but routine provision in primary care teams for that kind of thing is not currently recommended.
No. You should try and stop people consuming things that put the blood pressure up. So coffee, caffeine-rich products, so your caffeine-based fizzy drinks, your caffeine-based tablets, your
green
tea, yeah, lots of normal tea, yeah. And you should try and reduce salt intake to about 5 to 6 grams a day, and encourage a moderate alcohol consumption.
So you want to encourage people to eat fruit and vegetables and low-fat dairy products, aim to reduce their weight to a BMI of 25 or below, encourage regular exercise, so around about or over 30 minutes of moderate dynamic exercise 5 to 7 days per week, and if they smoke, to offer smoking cessation.
Yeah, those exercise guidelines are about to be rewritten, actually.
Okay.
And there are two bits I never knew, and we might talk about this in some detail, actually, because we might do an episode on the Falls conference that I went to. But in that, Dawn Skelton, who's an excellent exercise physiologist, was talking about those exercises, and actually there's two bits to those recommendations.
Okay.
One is aerobic exercise, which is what we've just talked about, so 30 minutes of moderate dynamic exercise a few days a week, and the second is there are actually guidelines on strength exercises.
Okay.
And kind of the definition of strength exercise is exercise that in the 24 to 48 hours afterwards leads to delayed onset muscle pain. Domps. And if you're not getting delayed onset muscle pain, then you're not building strength in the muscles.
Not working hard enough.
You're not working hard enough. You have to strain the muscles. And so you should be doing that at least twice a week.
Okay.
And a common aspect of all those studies looking at lifestyle interventions is the use of group working. And people exercise better if they're motivated to work in a group.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk later on in the series about pulmonary rehab, and that works better in a group as well. So you should try and fit people into local groups if they're up for that. identify local initiatives with healthcare teams or patient organisations that try and help people to promote a healthy lifestyle and provide support for them when they're trying to do that. Because it can be quite, well, it is quite difficult to change your lifestyle. You know, loads of people are trying to do it at all ages, and it's difficult to do.
So next we're going to move on to some studies and talk about some of the key studies that have been done in hypertension specifically for older adults rather than ones that have been done in younger cohorts, which have proved the benefit of managing high blood pressure, because this is a slightly more controversial area. It's got less research behind it, but it's important to understand what is there to know how we should be treating people.
So we're going to talk about four things. We're going to talk about the HIVET study.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about the SPRINT trial.
Yes.
We're going to talk about a Cochrane review. And we're going to talk about the PARTIDGE study. So, should we start with HIVET?
Let's. So, this was a randomised controlled trial.
And just for those of you that don't know, what you do is you have a population of people, you split them into two or more groups. One group you do something to, and one group you don't. And then you see the difference in the outcomes between those two groups. And ideally, as the person analysing the data, you don't know which group the person that you're analysing the data on comes from. So it's kind of blinded.
Yeah, so the people who don't have any treatment are the control group, and you're randomised as to which group you go in. So there's no bias involved in how you get there.
No. So HIVET was quite a big randomised trial.
It was, yes. So 3,845 patients from around the world. So Europe, China, Australasia and Tunisia. And everybody was 80 years of age or over and had a sustained high blood pressure. So a systolic blood pressure of over 160 or more. And they randomised them to receive either a diuretic, so in this case it was indapamide, or a placebo. Then an ACE inhibitor or a placebo was added if it was necessary to achieve a blood pressure target of 150 over 80. And the primary endpoint was fatal or non-fatal stroke. So the endpoint means the thing that they're measuring for directly. They may measure and monitor for other benefits or disadvantages along the way as well. But that was what they were designed to do. And what they found was an average blood pressure reduction of 15 millimetres of mercury systolic and 6 diastolic.
So that in itself, I think, is interesting because if you follow a lot of the antihypertensive guidelines, you wouldn't kick off with a diuretic in older people.
No.
And the study does. And then they add an ACE inhibitor, which also wouldn't necessarily be my first line treatment.
Although we're not talking about medications today.
And I think what's interesting is that the combination of those two reduced the blood pressure by 15 systolic.
It's not that much.
So it's not huge. And therefore, I think you can surmise, and I think it's true, that most antihypertensives are only going to bring the blood pressure down by 5 to 10 millimetres of mercury. So if you've got someone who's running blood pressure at 170, you're not going to control it with one medication.
Yeah.
And the average number of medications to control blood pressure is just over 2. So I think when you're starting someone on treatment for hypertension, I think sometimes it's worth saying to them, it was not going to be unusual for us to add a second type of medication. Because otherwise I think there's a danger that, you know, when you say, oh, it's still not controlled, we're going to have to change treatment. People sometimes feel that like they've sort of failed it and it sounds bad. But I think sometimes at the beginning it's just useful to go, well, look, you might need a couple of medications to control this.
Yeah.
But that's no bad thing. That's probably what we expect.
Yeah.
And what they found was by treating hypertension in older patients, the outcomes were influenced positively. And these are outcomes in terms of, you know, cardiovascular mortality, all-cause mortality, and so on. So based on that data set, NICE has recommended that not only do we treat hypertension in patients who are under 80, treat it in over 80-year-olds.
So active treatment, so the group that had drugs, was associated with a 30% reduction in the rate of fatal or non-fatal stroke.
Good thing.
A 39% reduction in the rate of death from stroke.
Also good.
Also very good. A 21% reduction in the rate of death from any cause.
Very good.
A 23% reduction in the rate of death from cardiovascular cause and a 64% reduction in the rate of heart failure.
So I think that's all really good.
All really good.
Yeah. It's worth thinking, though, that if you looked at the patients with frailty,
mm-hmm.
They got even bigger treatment effects from blood pressure lowering. But the participants in HIVET were all aged over 80, but their mortality was a little bit less than you'd expect for a normal group of people over 80. They had much lower rates of diabetes and cardiovascular disease, partly because of the way the trial was constructed.
Yeah.
So the SPRINT study, quite an exciting study, and it's very pertinent to talk about SPRINT in the context of treating hypertension, particularly in older people. Now, in the old, we've been brought up with this data that suggests that the lower the blood pressure, particularly in older people, that below a certain threshold, you may well be causing adverse cardiovascular outcomes. There has been a lot of caution, understandably so, in treating hypertension. But what the SPRINT study has demonstrated, in fact, the study was stopped after 3.5 years, after drafting in several thousand patients, was that if you lower blood pressure to an even lower threshold than the thresholds we have today, going by the guidelines we have, that the outcomes are even better. And there was a sizable number of older patients in the SPRINT study cohort. You know, up to a quarter of patients were older patients. So if that's the case, then perhaps we should be treating blood pressure to a lower target. And I suspect the trend in clinical guidelines for hypertension will follow this based on the SPRINT data set. The Americans have already released new guidelines which have adjusted their targets to much lower levels, and I suspect this will come into Europe and the UK with time. However, in treating hypertension in older people, the benefits of doing this have to be balanced against the risks. It's pointless in aggressively treating blood pressure only to cause older people to fall over, because that in itself is associated with quite a lot of morbidity and perhaps mortality. So the important thing is that individualized care, that the data from the studies like the SPRINT study are based on clinical trial data. We must be cognizant of that fact. In the real world, each patient is an individual. And we've just got to do things sensibly.
The next study we're going to talk about is the SPRINT trial. And this was published much more recently. And SPRINT, again, was a trial with a large number of people, 9,361 adults over the age of 50.
Oh, you see, we're getting into that old thing again.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a minute. Who had a systolic blood pressure of 130 or higher, which is a bit lower than a lot of the guidelines we talked about at the beginning of the show. And also had at least one other cardiovascular disease risk factor. Approximately a third of the people in SPRINT were over the age of 75, and also a third had chronic kidney disease.
Okay.
So now
I feel better about this, because generally not many people under the age of 50 will have hypertension. So this is just a general study.
Yeah. In adults over 50 who had high blood pressure and one additional risk factor, but with no history of diabetes or stroke, the study showed that by treating a blood pressure down to less than 120 reduces the rates of complications such as heart attack, heart failure and stroke, similar to HIVET, by 25%.
Mm-hmm.
But then compared with the standard blood pressure target of 140, treating people again to 120 lowered the risk of death by a third. Now, SPRINT included a large group of people over the age of 75. So in those people, a separate analysis confirmed that treating to a lower blood pressure target reduced complications of high blood pressure and saved lives in the older people in the study, even the older people who had poor overall health.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important because a large percentage of the population, both here in the UK but also in the US and around the world, are over the age of 75 and have a higher blood pressure. Similar to that, if you give even lower blood pressure targets, you get more improvement and no difference in kidney outcomes. So renal disease wasn't changed, interestingly. And they stopped the SPRINT study early because the findings were so significant. What's interesting with SPRINT is that your degree of frailty, separate to your age, had no association with the treatment effect, which is different to HIVET, who the more frail people got better results.
Mm. But I think we just have to keep that in mind, don't we, that yeah. isn't everybody, that we as healthcare professionals, in secondary care in particular, are more likely to be seeing those people who are suffering side effects of these things and to not be skewed in our vision yeah. of the people that can benefit, because these studies are showing that with the right selection, there is benefit of treating high blood pressure. But it isn't quite as simple as the studies no. make it sound.
Would you like some data to back that up?
Yes, please.
Yes. So the Cochrane Review in 2017 looked at a group of randomised control trials and looked at treating blood pressure to two different targets. And essentially they found that treating to one target which was less than 140 mm-hmm. or one target that was less than 160 made no difference at 2 or 4 years in either of their primary outcomes, which was mortality, stroke or cardiovascular events. They did say that the data, the quality of the evidence is relatively low quality mm-hmm. in the studies they looked at, but there is some suggestion that a target of 150 over 90 was all right.
Okay.
So it is not the end of the world to run people a little bit higher.
And that's in line with the HIVET, which is what they were aiming for in that study as well, isn't it? What's interesting is that gap then with what the SPRINT is showing is that getting it down even further can reduce those yeah. complications even more, which isn't quite borne out in that Cochrane review. But it's difficult to do Cochrane reviews because they have the inclusion criteria, they have to include studies, is quite strict. So quite often they end up with only a few studies that they're including.
And that brings us back to the European Society question, is people with a blood pressure between 140 and 160, should we treat them or not?
Mm.
I think the jury's still out, personally. Part of the reason is I wonder whether or not blood pressure is the right thing to measure.
Yeah. We've had this conversation, haven't we? I was very excited you found this study. Yeah.
So this is something called the Partage study.
Mm-hmm.
The Partage study looked at just over 1,000 people, 874 of which were women, who were living in France and Italian nursing homes. I assume they either lived in France, French or Italian nursing homes. I don't think they all lived in them together. But,
and that they were in France or Italy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, they were 88. So good,
average age.
A good average age. And they looked at carotid and peripheral, so brachial, pulse pressure amplification. And they measured that with the help of an arterial tonometer. So I believe that is sort of measuring the tone in blood vessels rather than the blood pressure. And they had a two-year follow-up. And what they saw was that a 10% increase in your pulse pressure amplification,
which is the difference between the central and the peripheral artery,
is associated with a 24% decrease in mortality and a 17% decrease in cardiovascular events. Systolic blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure and pulse pressure, which is the difference between the two, were not associated inversely with total mortality or the cardiovascular events.
Mm, okay.
So what they concluded is that a low pulse pressure amplification from central to peripheral arteries strongly predicts mortality and adverse events, and that high blood pressure was not associated with a higher risk of mortality or cardiovascular events in that population.
And that population, because they're in nursing homes, you would assume by definition are a frailer cohort.
Yeah.
So this was the conversation that we had before, was, is blood pressure, you know, with a cuff, the right way to measure this? If there's a lot of stiffness and calcification in the arteries, is it just we have to squeeze them really hard to occlude them and therefore we get a high reading, where actually what's the flow in the blood vessel? Is that necessarily going to be different? Which is something, until we found the study, we had no answer for, but this seems like actually that is a potential theory there.
Yeah. So I think watch this space on that.
Yeah, interesting. But I think when it comes down to, as you said, in that group where you're not really sure whether you should be treating or not, is to do shared decision making and talk to the person about their priorities and how they feel about having a high blood pressure and what they would like to do about it. It's also taking into account lots of their comorbidities to see how many other medications they're on, is it going to upset one of the other treatments that you're already giving them, is it going to cause them postural hypertension if they've already got a little bit of that. So it's really important to think about. So this links in a bit to the advanced care planning episode we did at the beginning of this series, where we talked about studies that were demonstrating safety in de-prescribing antihypertensives medications. So thinking about the numbers involved, like numbers needed to treat, if you wanted to kind of have some numbers to talk to patients about to help with their decision making, you need to treat about 125 patients with a blood pressure of 170 systolic for 5 years to prevent one death in that group. Less still need to be treated to prevent a stroke, so you only need to treat 67 people to prevent one stroke and 48 people to prevent heart failure.
But that's still quite a lot.
And it is still quite a lot,
that's
yeah.
That's still then the bit that you discuss with the patients and say, well, you know, there are benefits to doing this, but if you're getting side effects from the treatments, are the benefits worth the side effects?
Mm.
And that's the discussion. And that links in with the episode we talked about, the multi-morbidity guidelines.
Mm.
And that was the episode at the beginning of Series 3. So go back and have a listen to that. And we went through a framework there, which is laid out in the NICE guidelines of how to have that conversation with people.
Yeah. And they have to be treated for 5 years as well.
Yeah.
So one of the ways that I talk to patients about this, because people can be quite apprehensive about stopping antihypertensives, especially when they've been, the importance of them has been pressed upon them for so long, and something they're very used to. I don't know what you say, but I usually say all of that benefit that you've had, you still carry with you going forward from this point. What we're looking at now is what's going to happen over the next 5 years. And if you've got someone that's quite frail in front of you, you can then say, well, we're looking at what's going to help you in the next 5 years. And sometimes I'll say to you, well, I don't imagine I'll be alive then. And then you can kind of say, well, you know, that's why we're having this conversation. That's how I lead into it. What do you say?
Yeah, something very similar, really. I tend to sort of go in by saying, you know, how, certainly in clinic, you know, sort of how do you see the next few years panning out?
Mm.
And using that as the start to a conversation about, yeah, you know, well, what are your priorities over that time? Therefore, you know, what medications and stuff link into that?
Yes. Yeah, so the other way I say it is we're looking at something that's going to help you in a few years' time by these numbers that we've quoted, or stopping, which will help you day to day, particularly if they're falling over with postural hypotension. And that's kind of how I frame things.
Yes. So there are some special situations, though. So we're now going to hear Mike from Brighton talk through a few special situations where you may want to treat people with hypertension a bit differently.
So hypertension is very strongly linked with cardiovascular risk, and one of the conditions we think about is stroke. In fact, hypertension is one of the most important risk factors in developing stroke. Generally, what the evidence suggests to us is that following a stroke, in the medium to long term, optimal blood pressure control is beneficial. Okay, in the medium to long term. But in the acute setting, it's slightly different. And oftentimes there is a dilemma between whether you treat blood pressure or continue antihypertensives or not. Now, up to 70% of patients who have had an acute stroke have got hypertension, elevated blood pressure. And half of those have hypertension before that and are on antihypertensive drugs. The data, there is a data suggesting that the continuation of antihypertensive drugs needs to be cautious. It needs to be purposeful as well. And what the guidelines recommend now, based on reviews, Cochrane reviews and other pieces of evidence, is that if the blood pressure is very high, antihypertensive agents should be continued, or the blood pressure should be treated. And very high, the guidelines seem to agree on a figure of a systolic blood pressure of around 220 in the acute setting. Now, if the blood pressure is not up to 220, the recommendation is that the blood pressure should be left well alone until the patient is stabilised, and then very gradually antihypertensive agents can be introduced. So the advice is that in the acute setting, if the blood pressure is not very high, do not continue antihypertensives. And that's because it will lower the blood pressure, but it will be associated with adverse outcomes in relation to their functional recovery, in relation to mortality, in relation to length of stay. If the blood pressure is very high, then over 220 millimeters of mercury systolic, then there is a case for the treatment of it or the continuation of antihypertensive agents. And this is particularly important in a hospital setting where nurses can become quite alarmed by at very high blood pressures.
The MDT podcast.
So that's everything. That's the key stuff that we were going to talk about.
Yes.
It's good to have Mike involved. Thank you very much. And thank you for the contributions from Pam and the rest of the faculty. And now it's time for the MD teaser, which is our catchily titled MDT item guessing game. And this one is a verbal catchphrase.
Thanks, faculty.
Joe's going to go first for this one. So you're going to describe something and I'm going to try and guess what it is.
I am. Okay.
Please play along at home and please try and help me.
How are they going to help you?
I have no idea.
You're alone. Okay. In this scene, there are some chairs which are around an object which you would expect them to be around. And there's an arrow pointing towards this.
Mm-hmm. Is this a tilt table?
Oh, come on, let me get to it.
Okay,
what I was going to describe was a can of drink that was really very tropical tasting with an L over the top crossed out. So it's going to be tilt, not lilt.
Sorry, I guessed it too soon.
She shouldn't have gone in with the table. Anyway.
Okay. So, this
All
one.
Right. I'm
okay.
ready.
So this will go one of two ways.
Ian's drawn them this week.
Yeah, I've drawn them this week. So what I've drawn is there are three characters in the centre.
Yeah.
Moving around, sort of in little circles, and they are holding placards. One placard says parasite. One placard says bacteria.
MCNS.
One placard says virus. Around the outside of them is a fence. And marshalling the fence are some more characters.
Is it antibiotic stewardship?
And one of them has a placard that says apron. And one says antibiotic. And one said antivirus. And the other one says hand washing.
Campaign. Something
almost.
Campaign.
Yeah.
Antibiotic campaign. Infection control campaign.
That's it. Yeah. Infection control, so you're controlling the infection.
I see.
Fenced area. So we have an MD teaser for you.
Yes.
Head along to Twitter.
Yeah.
And it's pinned to our Twitter handle, which is MDT_podcast. And
using the hashtag MD teaser.
And send us your guesses, or you can contact us via the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk.
Or on facebook.com/MDT podcast.
Yeah. So the two hashtags, MD teaser, win a mug if you're the first person to guess this one. And the other hashtag is the MDT club.
For the general chat around the topics that we've been discussing in each episode.
Yeah. And as ever, on the website are the show notes, the references, the curriculum mapping, the CPD log, the infographics, the whole shebang. It's all there. Go for it.
Yes. So, finally, to close the show, we are going to enter the gallery. And Ian has something for us this time.
So, I have a poem by Alison Bolas. And we've talked about Alison before, I think, but I don't think we've used one of her poems before. So, Alison is a lady who's very nicely given us permission to use her poems. And Alison is a lady who has dementia and quite a young onset dementia. So, this is called Just One Word. Just one word. My word to use as necessary. Not for anyone else to grasp and commandeer. Alzheimer's. Just one word. But what a word. A word that long ago was unfamiliar to me. A word that now tries to threaten me, limit me, confine me. A word that makes me feel diminished. A word that I hardly knew from the innocent time before I was diagnosed and my downward slide began. A a word that is now commonplace, but still a metaphoric bullet to the brain.
So that's it from us. MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a hearing aid podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.